From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. You can add White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany to the list of people close to the president who have now tested positive for the coronavirus. She says she has no symptoms and will quarantine. The president, meanwhile, remains hospitalized at Walter Reed Medical Center, and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows says doctors will determine today whether the president can be discharged. Joining us now is Dr. Jewel Mullen, an epidemiologist at the University of Texas, Austin, and former Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Health in the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Mullen, we know that President Trump has received an experimental antibody treatment, an FDA-approved drug that might shorten the illness, and a steroid. What does that combination tell you about what he's going through?
I appreciate your question because I imagine there are people hospitalized all around the country wondering whether or not they might be able to get some of these medications too. Each of the medications, dexamethasone, the Regeneron drug, and remdesivir, are at this point at different stages of approval or use. I look at the Regeneron medication as one that, although we don't have any good evidence yet to base decisions about it on, it's still experimental. The thinking is that would be something that's more preventive and a drug that would be able to cut down on a severe illness. Remdesivir originally was used for sort of the sickest patients in hospitals, and last month, still under emergency use authorization, the FDA allowed that it could be used for hospitalized adults and children. And then dexamethasone, that extremely strong steroid medication, again, is one that is reserved for use in the sickest patients hospitalized. And that goes along with a caution that there could be risks to using it early in disease. So there's a bit of a spectrum going on here that makes it hard for me to know because we only have a certain degree of evidence about any of these medications individually, and no real understanding of what the combination of them will do for a person.
Could his symptoms, the president's symptoms, do you think, be more severe than the team is letting on? I mean, he's done these videos, so we've seen him for a couple of minutes at a time, but is it really possible to hide symptoms if they are very severe with COVID-19?
As I think about the different ways in which we have learned COVID has impacted people, we've heard about individuals who have said they or their family members went from seeming fairly well and looking fairly well, even without realizing that their oxygen levels were extremely low, and seeming okay, or even as if they were recovering maybe a week into the illness, and then going downhill and having a severe outcome later on. You know, people talk about COVID in ways that remind us how unpredictable the course might be for one. And so with that being said, I wouldn't take any particular confidence, even if somebody is feeling okay at this point, particularly an older person with underlying conditions that make them a greater risk for having complications.
Well, and also, isn't it the case that COVID-19 often has, you know, ups and downs, that you may feel like you're recovering and then things get worse?
Yes. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So what questions do you still have about the president's condition?
If I just get clinical, then what I would say is it's interesting to consider what this combination that some have referred to as sort of an everything but the kitchen sink approach might lead to in the end, because everything with potential benefit here also comes with potential risks.
What is the side effect that you would be most concerned about from any of these medications that we mentioned that he's taking?
Well, for months now, we've lived with the recognition that early use of a very strong steroid like dexamethasone cuts down on one's immune response and therefore one's ability to fight other infections, and may actually, you know, be associated with a worsened course. You know, we've also had concerns about worsening or impairment of liver and kidney function, blood sugar associated with remdesivir. And then we don't know about what the potential impacts of any of those combinations of medications would be.
That is Dr. Jewel Mullen, an epidemiologist at the University of Texas, Austin. Doctor, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
President Trump has been sending messages about his condition to the public through Twitter, including a video message yesterday from the hospital.
So it's been a very interesting journey. I learned a lot about COVID. I learned it by really going to school. This is the real school. This isn't the let's read the book school. And I get it and I understand it.
Joining us now to talk more about this is former chair of the Republican National Committee, Michael Steele. He's a member of the Lincoln Project, a group of Republicans working against President Trump, and he has endorsed Democratic candidate Joe Biden. Welcome to Here and Now.
It's good to be with you.
So, Michael, as a Republican, you're one of the few that has been publicly critical of the Trump administration. I want to talk with you more about the state of the Republican Party. But first, we're getting conflicting messages about the president's health. What would you like to see the administration and the Trump campaign do now in response?
Just be honest for once, you know, and in 4 years, be honest at least about the health of the president. And the problem is the president is dictating the talking points. He's dictating the narrative, and he's pushing this strongman ideal that, you know, somehow he's bigger and better than COVID. He's a 74-year-old obese white man. This is not a good scenario to have COVID-19 in. So honesty, caution, those things would be very helpful in this in this hour, but I don't think we'll see it coming.
Well, on Wednesday night, Vice President Mike Pence is scheduled to appear in the first vice presidential debate. What messages do you want to hear from him specifically on the coronavirus response? He was the head of the White House Coronavirus Task Force.
He's going to try to placate Trump as much as possible. I mean, Trump essentially took over the leadership of the task force, even though he put the vice president in charge. So it's going to be an interesting little walk for him to try to promote the efforts that he was pushing inside the task force versus what ultimately was put out in front of the public, which was a lot of counter messaging, a lot of confusion. And it'll be a very different debate from the one we saw last week because, you know, Pence doesn't have a blustering kind of personality. So he's actually going to try to answer the questions. And that's where it's going to get, I think, a little bit dicey.
What advice would you give to lawmakers who failed so far to reach another coronavirus relief deal? Who needs to give up what?
Well, you know, the reality of it is the Democrats started at $3 trillion. The Republicans wanted no more than $1 trillion in new relief. The Democrats have come down to $1.5 trillion, and the Republicans are $2 trillion, and the Republicans are still on $1 trillion. And so there is no effort to move forward on this. They are fast-tracking the nomination of Judge Barrett to the Supreme Court, and slow tracking relief for families and communities on coronavirus. And that tells you everything you need to know about this moment where the priorities of the administration and the Republican leadership. And I hate saying this as a Republican. It's just stunning to me that we can be so tone deaf to what's going on in the country.
Well, I want to ask you about that. I mean, Trump is such a dominant force that he silences almost all criticism from within the party. How would you describe the state of the party right now?
A mess, disjointed, unfocused, undisciplined, voiceless. And that's evident by the fact that the party didn't have a platform. Remember, the leadership came in saying that we would, you know, we would manage the president. We would help him as a you know, political neophyte. And what have we seen? Nothing but capitulation and collaboration as opposed to strong-handed guidance for a guy who has no clue what he's doing.
Well, you've said in the past that it's important for people like you as a man of color to be in the room, so to speak. Well, what keeps you in the room at this point as a Republican when so much of the party is dominated by Trump politics?
because someone has to keep the lights on for the values that drew me to the party as a young man. I still think those things matter. I still think being responsible to the communities in which we live, helping create economic engines so businesses can thrive and grow, making government work for people, those things still have some value for me. But right now, the fight is worth it, and we'll see how the voters judge it this November. And if they judge that Trump deserves another 4 years, I can only tell you, strap in, because the next 4 years will make the last four look like calm and less chaotic.
Michael Steele is former chair of the Republican National Committee. Michael, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Today, the U.S. Supreme Court begins a new term virtually with just 8 justices instead of 9 after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. There will be a number of major cases as the looming confirmation process for a Supreme Court justice nominee. Oh, and an election less than a month away. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is with us now. Hi, Nina.
Hi there.
Well, because of the pandemic, the court is going to continue hearing arguments by phone as they did in the last term. And the Affordable Care Act is once again before the court. Remind us, what is at stake here and how likely is it that the court will end up striking it down?
Well, this is the third challenge brought by Republicans against Obamacare. This time, the Trump administration and a coalition of red states are arguing that because the Republican Congress 3 years ago zeroed out the monetary penalty for those not covered by insurance, the whole law is void. And if they were to prevail, that would mean that some 22 million people would lose their existing insurance under the program, and all the other provisions of the law would be gone, too, like the provision barring discrimination based on pre-existing medical conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't know. This will not be heard until the week after the election, when Judge Barrett might be Justice Barrett.
So, interesting.
If that were to happen, the calculus would be different than today.
What other major cases would come before the court, which also could end up in that situation where you have a Justice Barrett joining the other 8 members?
There are a lot of them. There's a couple of big religion cases. But the biggest potential for controversy right now, I think, are the numerous cases that are being teed up involving election rules and alleged violations and suppression of the vote and not suppression of the vote and voting machines. And if the upcoming election is close, one or more of these cases could end up deciding who is the next president.
Well, let's talk about the confirmation process for Judge Amy Coney Barrett, because a week from today, the Senate Judiciary Committee is set to begin the confirmation hearings. But at least 2 Republican members of the committee, Mike Lee of Utah and Tom Tillis of North Carolina, have tested positive for coronavirus. How are these hearings going to be able to go ahead given that?
Well, that's a very, very good question. Right now, Republicans are on track pushing this through before the election. But the execution of this has to be perfect. And if it isn't, there may not be a quorum for a vote in the Judiciary Committee, for instance, because even though senators in the committee can vote by proxy, a majority has to be there in person. Of course, if there's no quorum, Mitch McConnell could just try to move the nomination directly to the floor for the first time in a century. I think it's a century. But there, you can't vote by proxy. And if you want to change the rules, you need 60 votes to change the rules. And if this is after the election and the Democrats win, there's at least one potentially new senator who could take his seat in November. That's Mark Kelly in Arizona, because he would be filling the McCain seat, the John McCain seat. So it gets really complicated.
Well, let's play that out for a second here, because if the Democrats win, let's even say it's a landslide for the Democrats and they haven't gotten Amy Coney Barrett through at that point, would Republicans in that kind of a position, do you think, still push to try to get this nominee through in a lame duck session?
Well, that's a really interesting Washington parlor game. as I said, the Republicans wouldn't have probably a 4-vote majority anymore if the Democrats won big. Mark Kelly would take his seat if he won. And the whole political calculus might change or not. I mean, this is one of those things that when I say perfect execution, I mean perfect execution. And if they don't do it as a perfect execution, we could be in a very different situation. But I don't see that right now.
Nina, just briefly, if Coney Barrett does get on the court, I assume that means John Roberts is no longer really a swing vote anymore.
I think that's likely. He would no longer have the controlling vote. Now, he very rarely separates himself from fellow conservatives, but he's done it in a couple of very big cases and important cases. And if Judge Barrett is confirmed and joins the court, it means that there are 6 conservative votes on the court. And that means that if Roberts or some other justice flakes off in some case, the court's hardline conservative majority can afford to lose one vote and still prevail.
Mm-hmm. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, the presidency and seats in Congress are not the only offices on the ballot in November. The upcoming election will also determine control of state legislatures across the country. And in many states, that will also determine which party gets to redraw the congressional districts. We're going to take a look at that now, the outlook for state houses across the country, with Politico reporter Zach Montalero. Hi, Zach.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, so redistricting happens every 10 years, and the last time it happened after the 2010 midterm elections, in President Obama's first term, Republicans won big that year. Which party has the advantage going into 2020?
Well, right now, it's certainly looking a lot different than 2010. In 2010, Republicans wiped the floor with Democrats. I don't think anyone would deny that. And now Republicans still control a lot of these chambers, but Democrats are very, very close to flipping a lot of chambers and getting a lot of footholds in a bunch of redistricting states in the next year.
And what kind of difference could that make for congressional races if Democrats do end up flipping a lot of these legislative chambers?
Yeah, who controls these chambers is incredibly important. It's something like a handful of state legislative races, about 60 of them, could ultimately decide how over 100 congressional seats are redrawn, and in fact, much more than that. So with Democrats being so close to flipping chambers in states like Texas, North Carolina, Florida, you know, when it's really only a couple of seats here and there that could really decide the majority, Republican or Democrats, what would be small state house races, races that wouldn't draw a lot of attention, are going to be incredibly consequential for what Congress looks like in the next 10 years and what those state legislatures look like, too, because they're going to be redrawing their own maps in some situations as well.
Well, let's talk about a few of the states that you just mentioned. Democrats in Texas are trying to break up what they call a Republican trifecta there, which means Republicans control both chambers of the state legislature as well as the governorship. Tell us what's going on in Texas.
Yeah, so I think Texas will be the most competitive state down ballot for state legislative races. Everybody is gunning for it. I think you could probably conservatively estimate the amount of money going in from both sides to be in the tens of millions, if not a lot more than that. In a universe 10 years ago, you couldn't really imagine Democrats ever chipping away. Democrats are really, really close to doing so in both chambers. Collectively, between the state House and the state Senate, they need to flip about 13 seats in both to flip both chambers. Both of these chambers are in play.
Uh-huh. What about Florida, where Republicans have a trifecta as well? They control both chambers of the legislature and the governorship. Is that likely to change after the 2020 election?
Yeah, so Florida is another one of the states where right now Republicans control every lever for the redistricting process, but Democrats could theoretically change that. You know, Florida is the state where Democratic dreams go to die every cycle, be it a governor's race, be it a Senate race, be it the presidency. But that being said, Democrats are pretty dang close in both chambers. They need, you know, about 13 seats in the state House chamber or 3 seats in the state Senate chamber to get a majority. It's no guarantee they pick it up, of course, but especially in the state House, there's a handful of Republicans there that represent districts that Hillary Clinton carried in 2016. So Democrats are also investing a lot of money into that state too to try to flip one of the chambers. You know, again, Florida has historically, you know, like Lucy and the football, pulled away from the Democrats at the last minute, but right. They're expected to be competitive this year at least.
Okay, and what about North Carolina? Republicans there control both chambers of the state legislature, but not the governor's office. That would be Democrat Roy Cooper. North Carolina could be a crucial swing state in the presidential race this time around. What's going on there? What are you watching for in terms of the state legislature?
Yeah, so the interesting thing about North Carolina is that despite the fact that Governor Cooper, a Democrat, controls the governor's mansion, he doesn't have much of a say in the redistricting process at all. That state has seen its map drawn and redrawn several times over the last decade due to court orders, so it's going to be another big battleground. Their Democrats, again, are close in both chambers, and that's really the situation in state after state across the country, that even where Republicans control both chambers, Democrats are close. It's, can they flip the seats that Hillary Clinton carried in 2016? Because that would get them a heck of a lot closer. It's a big deal for Democrats in North Carolina. It's a state that's increasingly becoming purple on the national scale, and Democrats mm-hmm. hope to match that in the state legislative race as well.
What other states are you watching closely?
So one state I think that's actually kind of interesting to watch is Kansas. You know, not what you would typically think of as a super competitive state, but their Democrats have kind of the opposite. They have the governor's mansion, but they have super minorities in both chambers. So Democrats want to protect the veto of their governor in that state. And if they can flip a couple of seats in each chamber, they could do that. They don't have to get a majority. They won't get anywhere close to a majority. But what they're looking for is to have not a super minority. So that's going to be interesting in Kansas. And, you know, you can basically follow the presidential race to try to find the most competitive state legislative races as well. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Georgia, states like Pennsylvania, states like Minnesota. Those two will all have competitive races. Minnesota is kind of mm-hmm. the opposite, that in Minnesota, Republicans are trying to pick up seats to prevent Democrats from having a trifecta there. Republicans right now have the state Senate. They would like to make some gains in the state House, but there's a Democratic governor.
That is reporter Zach Montalero of Politico. Zach, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Today, the Nobel Prize in Medicine went to three scientists who discovered the blood-borne virus hepatitis C. The scientists are Harvey J. Alter at the National Institutes of Health, Charles M. Rice from Rockefeller University in New York, and Michael Houghton, a British virologist at the University of Alberta in Canada. For more, we have Angela Rasmussen. She is a virologist at Columbia University. Professor, in layman's terms, what did these scientists do that was so important that they got this prize?
So these three scientists all contributed immensely to our understanding that hepatitis C virus was actually a virus and was not hepatitis A or hepatitis B. So Harvey Alter made the observation that patients were contracting viral hepatitis and it was not caused by either of those two other hepatitis viruses. Michael Houghton discovered and cloned the virus, which was then being called non-hep A, non-hep B hepatitis. And Charlie Rice was the one who finally showed that that virus is actually what causes hepatitis C, viral hepatitis. So together, the three of them made really important observations that allowed us to understand that this was a distinct virus so that we could start developing drugs to treat it and so that we could start making sure that the blood supply was safe.
So the World Health Organization estimates some 71 million people across the world have chronic hepatitis C. Rates in the U.S. are going up right now because of the opioid epidemic. How directly did the work of these three scientists lead to treatment that is now saving lives?
Well, it was absolutely critical to recognize that this was a different virus, because although hepatitis A and hepatitis B are also both viral infections, they're really very different viruses from hepatitis C virus. So in order to develop targeted therapies that could effectively treat hepatitis C, we had to understand what the virus was and also how that virus worked. And all of their work really contributed to this, because the early treatments for hepatitis C wasn't effective for treating many people. The new generation of drugs that are available now actually directly targets hepatitis C virus and can, in most cases, actually cure people of it.
Mm-hmm. But those drugs are notoriously expensive. Many people can't afford them. And in fact, 400,000 people a year still die from hepatitis C.
That's true. And hepatitis C is also a huge problem outside of the U.S. So there's definitely a lot more work to be done in terms of being able to get those drugs out equitably and make them available to all the people who are affected by this virus.
What is the significance to you of this prize going to something related to hepatitis C in the midst of the global COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, I'm always glad to see virologists being recognized for their important work. And I myself did my postdoctoral fellowship studying hepatitis C virus. One thing that's always struck me about it is how little attention it gets. There are vastly more people worldwide infected with hepatitis C virus than even HIV. And yet people don't think about hepatitis C virus the same way as a pandemic disease that kills people. So it's really good, I think, for the Nobel Committee to recognize that this virus is a huge global public health problem and that these three scientists made really important contributions so that we could understand it better and treat it.
Well, I must say that for myself and for all of our listeners, especially over the last many months, we all understand the importance of virologists. So thank you for what you do. Angela Rasmussen at Columbia University, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
What we love to eat and what we can afford to eat. It's a story that is uniquely American, shaped by economics, geography, and immigration. This week, we're going to examine how some of our food ways are changing because of COVID-19 and this country's racial reckoning in a series we're calling We Are What We Eat. Today, Chef Sean Sherman joins us. Sherman is a cookbook author and creator of the Indigenous Food Lab, and he's in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Sean, you are a member of the Oglala Lakota tribe and grew up in the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. Still, when you decided to write a Lakota cookbook and explore what you call pre-colonization foods, you found there weren't any cookbooks and that information was rather scarce and really just generalized all indigenous food ways. How did you go about doing the research and creating these recipes?
Well, there had been a few other indigenous cookbooks out there, but I was looking for something a little bit more specific that really focused on regional indigenous foods and really kind of encompassed the vast knowledge of indigenous peoples around their food systems. So, you know, the vast knowledge of wild plants around us and all the different uses of these plants, whether it's food or medicine or crafting, looking at Native American heirloom varietals of agriculture. So really digging into that history and looking at what seeds are still alive and available today from indigenous communities of all these different varieties of corn and beans and squash and sunflower and things like that. And just looking at how people are preparing things and, you know, just kind of took me on a journey to look at all of this history through a culinary lens and try to discern like what are true regional indigenous flavors that really kind of showcase our amazing diversity that we have across the United States and Canada and basically everywhere.
Yes. I mean, I'm so fascinated when you say trying to find what seeds are still alive. What recipes and ingredients were hard to find? Is there a specific dish that feels like home to you?
Well, one that I always refer to is a really simple dish just called wojapi, which is just, it was traditionally chokecherry, which was this fruit that grows out on the plains and around the Black Hills. And it was something that Lakota people had been harvesting for a long time. And it just reminds me of being a kid in my grandmother's house and just the flavor and the aroma of that particular piece. But the, you know, there's a lot of pieces that we've lost over the years. And, you know, it's looking at the true histories of what happened in the United States, especially to indigenous peoples and especially to like my own family, you know, because I look at like my great grandfather's era, who was born in the late 1860s, and he sees many clashes with the U.S. government, and he eventually sees the formation of Pine Ridge Reservation. He sees his kids having to go to boarding schools. He sees the Battle of Little Bighorn when he's 18. He sees the Wounded Knee Massacre. And, you know, so much to see in a single lifetime. And it was really that assimilation and boarding school efforts of the reservations that's been so damaging, because we started losing so much of our own indigenous education around our food ways and our cultures. And it's something that we're working really hard to try and bring back.
You know, you have me thinking about something that really defining American food is really hard, because it's kind of like asking, how do we define America, which is something that people struggle to answer, because in many ways it asks us to look at our past and all of the historical things that you were talking about that has happened to lots of different populations of people in the United States, first with the indigenous people. What does the idea of American food mean to you?
Well, I think that to really truly understand American food, you have to take into account all of this history, you know, because the United States government has really never come to terms of how it created so much privilege and wealth off of stolen indigenous lands and the decimation of indigenous peoples and off the backs of stolen indigenous African people on top of that. And, you know, there's really so much story to be told of the resiliency of these cultures that we have across the U.S. and this direct link of indigenous peoples that they have to community and to region and just to the plant and the environments around us, you know. So there's so much to learn. And I feel like if you're going to identify American food, you know, it's obviously not just hamburgers and soda. Like, you have to really dig deep and you have to see that there's so much amazing diversity that lies across the board, you know, with all the different areas of we have mountain regions and plains and coastal regions, and there's so much. And there's just, you know, there were so many indigenous communities and cultures, and you have to take that into account and understand that true diversity to start to understand true American food.
Your cookbook, The Sous Chef's Indigenous Kitchen, came out 3 years ago. And since then, you've really focused on teaching people about indigenous food ways. You are in the process, as I mentioned, of starting the Indigenous Food Lab. What do you hope this lab will do?
It's our kind of our nonprofit vision. So we're creating a kitchen that's dedicated and focused on research and development of more knowledge around indigenous food. It's we're going to be creating a lot of education and curriculum, and we're really just trying to create a safe place for people to have access if they want to understand more about indigenous food ways with all facets. So it's a study of wild foods and ethnobotany and native agriculture and seed keeping and farming techniques and medicinals and culinary and food preservation and even language and stories and art. You know, it all combines together surrounded by food. And our goal is to really help a lot of tribal communities that have suffered from so much and are still facing modern day segregation today. And we really want to help have healthy nutritional and cultural food access. And so we want to help build a new generation of native chefs and entrepreneurs and food producers. And hopefully, you know, we have this vision of one day being able to drive across the nation, stopping at indigenous focused food businesses and being able to experience this immense amount of diversity and just seeing how wonderful and how much bounty we have across this country.
As you speak, I'm thinking about how indigenous people have the highest rates of diabetes and are more likely than any other U.S. household to not have enough food to eat. This thing that you're doing, it really sounds like the healing of people through food.
Absolutely. You know, and I think it's going to be really important. And we see a really important path in the future to a better understanding of indigenous knowledge. And we feel like our generation has to be stewards of this knowledge. And it's not just here in the U.S. because colonization has affected people from all over the world, you know, throughout all of the Americas, Africa, India, Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, Hawaii. And everybody has these common stories of colonization. And we're still facing a lot of the aftermath of a lot of this history. And a lot of these indigenous populations have been left with kind of a perpetuated poverty, you know, with very little access to their own traditional foods and an immense amount of health disparity when it comes to food access and nutrition access. And we see a very clear path of helping people to preserve that knowledge and bring it back into their main lives and to really celebrate more regional and community-based food systems, you know, as I feel like COVID, we've really kind of shown us how vulnerable we are by being over-reliant on too much processed commercial foods that are coming from all over the place when we should really be focused on supporting our local growers, just as our indigenous ancestors did.
How has the pandemic impacted your efforts?
We still have a lot of things moving forward. And, you know, the whole food industry has been kind of turned on its head because of this COVID situation. But, you know, we see a very clear path of just helping to reset and taking this time for reflection and taking this time to do something positive for the future and making sure that we're helping other people, you know, create more food security because it's going to be a crazy time.
You all are doing this work, but what's your call to action for greater society?
Well, I think people really need to focus on regional foods. I think people really need to wake up and understand true histories and not ignore a lot of the tough histories that happened across this country. And I think there's a lot of lessons that we can learn from indigenous communities, how they're able to survive using basically just plants and animals of their region. And that there's so much, you know, the Western culinary diet has never really taken the time to learn this vast amount of botany around us and all these plants that are so giving to us. You know, so if you look at the world through an indigenous lens, you're going to see so much food and medicine and shelter and crafting and just the plant life around you. So there's so much to learn.
That's Chef Sean Sherman. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today is the last day to register to vote in 12 states. And of course, this year, many more Americans than usual are voting by mail because of the pandemic. President Trump has incorrectly raised doubts about fraud and mail-in voting. And while our next guest doesn't buy those claims, he does say that in a close election, mail-in voting could cost Democrats the presidency. Derek Thompson is staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So why do you believe that mail-in voting could cost Joe Biden the election if things are close?
Yeah, let me preface my answer by saying if things are close is an important qualifier. Right now, if you look at national polls, Biden is leading by an average of about 8 points nationally. That's not a particularly close election. And I also want to preface everything I'm about to say by saying that the president's claims that vote by mail is strewn with fraud, those are completely false. Fraud and vote by mail is about a 1 in 1 million occurrence. That said, the people that I spoke to, elections researchers at places like the Brookings Institution, told me that they are concerned, if not entirely panicked, that in a close election, having tens of millions of mail-in ballots could be a litigious mess, a legal mess. And that's because every single ballot in a close election in close states is going to be scrutinized. The postmark on the ballot, the signature, the envelope, all of it. And you're dealing with a scenario where you're going to be having lots of first-time mail-in voters who won't necessarily understand all of these rules. They might sign in the wrong place. They might not be able to include the right number of envelopes or forget to include the right number of envelopes. The post office might not postmark the ballot in the right spot. There have been already this year hundreds of thousands of mail-in ballots that have been tossed out because they weren't filled in right. And in a close election, hundreds of thousands of mail-in ballots being disqualified would, yes, of course, be a disaster for the party that is more likely to vote by mail, and that is Democrats.
Well, you know, it's interesting because what you're talking about is somebody actually voting by mail and then the ballot that they use being rejected after the fact. And you write that more than 23,000 mail ballots were rejected in the primaries in Wisconsin. That was larger than Donald Trump's margin of victory there in 2016. What has to happen for a ballot to be rejected? And do the rejected ballots tend to hurt the Democrats or the Republicans more?
So most of the time, absentee or mail-in ballots seem to be rejected for one of two reasons. One, because the ballot arrives too late to be counted, and so it is disqualified. Or two, there's something wrong with the signatures. Either there aren't the ballots aren't signed in all the right places, or the signature on the ballot doesn't match the signature that's on record. So signatures and envelopes and timing seem to be the biggest reason why these ballots are disqualified. To the second question, why does this matter more for Democrats? Well, it's two reasons. One, polls from August show that roughly half of Democrats say they're going to vote by mail. That's about four times more than the number of Republicans who say the same. Second, there have been studies looking at who is most likely to have their mail ballot rejected. There were two studies from Florida and Georgia looking at the 2018 midterm elections, and they found that young and minority voters were the most likely groups to have their mail ballots rejected. Well, young and minority voters are two groups that in the last few elections, and we should certainly think again in 2020, are more likely to skew Democratic. So not only are Democrats saying they're more likely to vote by mail, but also we seem to have some recent evidence that Democratic votes are more likely to be disqualified.
Well, are you seeing a change from Democratic officials in their messaging about this? Are they now moving to telling voters, hey, you know, if you haven't already voted by mail, maybe you actually should vote in person?
I've spoken to the Biden campaign about this, and I've read the reports from, say, April and March about what people were saying, governors were saying when this pandemic was hitting. And this is the distinction that I would draw out. Earlier in the spring, you had Minnesota, Virginia, Nevada, Pennsylvania, these governors and state leaders saying, stay home, especially if you're vulnerable. Please vote by mail. Now I would say it's a little bit more ambivalent. It's more about, let us try to provide you, the voter, with as much information as possible, depending on how you'd like to vote. If you'd like to vote by mail, we're going to give you as much information as we can to help you do that. But if you want to vote in person, either early or on election day, we're going to give information to help you vote that way as well. So the Democratic Party, I think, is more ambivalent on strategy and more about just getting accurate information there. I just want to be clear that my personal opinion is that given the observed difficulties and higher disqualification rates, not fraud rates, disqualification rates of mail ballots, my advice would be vote early, vote in person. Everything that we've learned from the last few months seems to suggest that voting in person is not as dangerous as we thought it was in the spring if you wear a mask and speak quietly.
Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.